What are Governor Newsom's priorities, and what is he willing to spend on them? That's what we'll hear later this morning in the 2020 State of the State Address. CAP Radio with KQED will bring you live coverage of that address starting at 10. First on Insight, CAP Radio State Government reporter Scott Rodd checks in from the Capitol. Lawmakers will gather there for the speech. We expect to hear about housing and homelessness, maybe a few surprises too. Also in this hour, I'll discuss the McClatchy bankruptcy filing announced last Thursday with media watcher Ken Doctor. McClatchy's first newspaper started in Sacramento in 1857. Later, a preview of the Jewish Film Festival this weekend in Sacramento. Among the films, a documentary on Dr. Ruth Westheimer, another short film about campfire recovery in paradise. I'm Beth Ruyak. There is a lot ahead today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. If Governor Gavin Newsom has new inspiration or new ideas to tackle California's housing and homelessness issues, today would be the right day to reveal them. His second State of the State address is coming up in just a few hours. You'll hear the speech live with special coverage from CAP Radio and KQED. That all starts at 10 a.m. CAP Radio's state government reporter Scott Rodd is at the Capitol in Sacramento, so let's do a bit of a check-in. Hi, Scott.
Good morning, Beth.
So I bet this is a quiet time down there. What's happening around you, and are you at all able to get a sense of anticipation?
So it is pretty quiet down here right now. There's a lot of setup happening. There are some mic checks going on. But there is a sense of anticipation. I mean, this is Gavin Newsom's, you know, second state of the state, you know, after his rookie year, so to speak, taking a look back at what has happened in that year and laying out the policy plan moving forward. So there's a bit of anticipation, and there's some pretty big issues facing the state. So there are some pretty high expectations as to what he may be talking about.
Key topics, of course, housing and homelessness, wildfires, education and health care. But I think housing and homelessness end up at the top of the marquee. Don't you think that will get the most attention?
Absolutely. You know, when I spoke to lawmakers earlier this year at the start of session and throughout the last couple weeks, that's been just a big talking point for them, trying to figure out what to do about homelessness in California. You know, the homeless population last year increased 16%. It's now over 150,000 in California. And so there's some high expectations as to, you know, how to address this problem and the tone and tenor that the governor is going to set.
So let's think back to last year and how he positioned himself on this issue and exactly maybe how ambitious he was about it. Is that a good way to characterize it?
Yeah, so he said he made clear that he thought that the state needed to play a bigger role in addressing homelessness. And we have a bite from last year's State of the State, and we'll give it a listen.
And while cities and counties are on the front line, this challenge will only be solved on a regional basis. So we need to work together as a state and regions to focus on prevention, rapid rehousing, mental health, and more permanent supportive housing. Because at the end of the day, shelter solves sleep. Housing and supportive services solve homelessness.
So that statement last year not only got big applause, but a standing ovation. Is there a perspective that he's moved toward actually solving what he wanted to?
You know, last year he signaled that he thought that the state needed to play a bigger role, as I said, and he that reflected in the budget this year, where he committed $1.4 billion to addressing homelessness through additional resources going towards affordable housing and for rental assistance. Last year, he committed $1 billion in his budget. And some challenges he faced was releasing some of that money to local jurisdictions to make sure that the aid was actually dispersed in a timely fashion. He had some tussles with the Trump administration to make sure that that money actually got to where it was intended to go. But he's showing with this $1.4 billion proposed in this year's budget that he continues to see the need to invest more than really ever before in addressing this problem.
And focusing on that money being dispersed in regions, let me bring up another topic. High-speed rail. got attention last year, and then the governor really shifted in his perspective and what was last year a very bold statement.
That's right. He laid out pretty clearly that he had a different vision for high-speed rail than his predecessor, Jerry Brown. And here's what he said during last year's State of the State.
But let's be real. The current project, as planned, would cost too much and respectfully take too long. There's been too little oversight and not enough transparency. Right now, there simply isn't a path to get from Sacramento to San Diego, let alone from San Francisco to L.A.
And then what happened, Scott?
Well, there was a lot of confusion over, well, what does this exactly mean? Is he calling for a scaled back version of high-speed rail? Is he talking about sort of reorienting the project altogether? And, you know, after that initial confusion, the governor's office came back and said, no, we're not trying to scrap, you know, trying to scrap high-speed rail. We're not trying to do some sort of drastic re-envision of it. But we do think that there needs to be a new emphasis placed on the Central Valley portion of the project, and then focusing on urban areas like San Francisco and LA. So it created some initial confusion up front, and then they started to clarify it, but there still are a lot of outstanding questions about the project as we speak.
Overall, going into the speech last year, there was a lot of anticipation. Gavin Newsom was a new governor, and now the latest PPIC poll is showing a 53% approval rating among adults, not just those likely to vote, 33% disapproving of him. But this is a strong platform to go into this message with. Perhaps the budget message, Scott, gave us a hint of where he'll focus money and time in this message. What else is your speculation?
You know, I do think that the budget was a useful preamble heading into the State of the State. And in fact, I did some reporting on how this year's State of the State, if people are wondering if it feels kind of late for this address to happen, that's because it is. This is actually the latest that the address has taken place in the calendar year. In the last 40 plus years. And I spoke to the governor's office about it. And, you know, they said the reason for that is intentional. They view the budget proposal as an opportunity to share what spending priorities will be for the state. And I vividly remember the 3 hours that Governor Newsom spent talking about it. And they said they want to leave some breathing room in between that proposal and this sort of forward-looking vision for the state as a whole. And so his policy proposals in the budget, as I mentioned before, spending on homelessness is a big one, but he also discussed prioritizing special education, really pumping funding into that, also improving and bolstering the number of teachers that California has. So there are expectations there that that there will be, you know, more discussion of those policy priorities, but there probably will also be discussion of things that don't fall neatly into a budget proposal, like being a foil to President Donald Trump, figuring out ways to clearly distinguish California's priorities, or at least in Newsom's mind and in Democrats' mind, California's priorities versus what's happening at the federal level.
All right. We also expect to hear about the wildfire situation and climate change, as well as PG&E. I alluded to maybe some surprises. How about we check back with you at the end of the show? And as people gather and you have more of an opportunity to talk to people, we'll see if anything else emerges, okay?
That sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
That is Cap Radio's state government reporter, Scott Rodd. Our live special coverage in partnership with KQED begins at 10 a.m. You will hear Governor Newsom's State of the State message, plus lawmaker reaction. And you'll hear some analysis from our guests, Luis Alvarado and Jody Balma. I'll be joined in the studio by Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos from KQED. Hope you'll join us. It all begins immediately following Insight. Up next in the hour, the McClatchy bankruptcy. I'll talk about it with media watcher Ken Doctor. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. News of McClatchy's Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing last Thursday went viral, though it was not a surprise to people who have been watching the newspaper industry overall, and that company in particular. McClatchy is the second largest newspaper publisher in the country. It's a company owned by the McClatchy family of Sacramento. The first paper was put together in 1857. So the company is now reported to have more than $700 million in debt. It has been in heavy debt since acquiring the Knight Ridder newspaper chain in 2006. Yesterday, a judge ruled that mediation with McClatchy's creditors can begin in 2 weeks. On the phone now is Ken Doctor. He's a news industry analyst and the author of a book from 2010 titled Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get. Hi, Ken. Glad to have you on Insight.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Give me your reaction when you heard this bankruptcy news.
It's something I've been covering for the last quarter at least, and the signs of all the stress on McClatchy have been there for a long time. This debt has been whittled down since that Knight Ridder acquisition, but it's been a heavy burden on that company, and it has been a question whether it could make it through without a bankruptcy. And then we had acknowledgement last fall that it would not be able to make a pension payment, and that turned out to be the factor that finally pushed them into bankruptcy.
We should be transparent. You worked for Knight Ridder, Ken, until it was sold to McClatchy in 2006. Is that correct?
No, I left the company in 2005. I left Knight Ridder. I worked for Knight Ridder Newspapers as an editor and on the digital side for 21 years, and I left in 2005, the year before it was sold.
All right. What did you see happening with Knight Ridder, and what was your view then of McClatchy?
Well, it was funny. We were in San Jose. I was working for Knight Ridder Digital at that point, and we thought that there might be some kind of combination between Knight Ridder and McClatchy, and especially the CEO of McClatchy at that point was Gary Pruitt, and we could see some kind of merger where Knight Ridder would buy McClatchy, Knight Ridder being the second largest company at that point. And so in 2006, when all of a sudden Knight Ridder said to its investors, you're right, we need to maximize value and we're going to sell, it was a shock throughout the newspaper world. And then to have the smaller McClatchy buy Knight Ridder was a second shock. So it was surprising to everybody. And as it turns out, if you look at it in retrospect, it was the beginning of the downturn of newspapers right in that period, 2006, 2007, and then the Great Recession, 2009, really took the wind out of the industry, and it's never been the same.
I don't know how to untangle all those circumstances and factors, but let me try this question. If the recession hadn't hit in 2007, do you think this deal would have or could have worked for McClatchy?
No, I think the problems were seeded earlier, and these were problems basically twofold if we take that long view. Newspaper readership had been going down for quite a while, but going down slowly. TV made inroads into it. If you go back to 1955, the household penetration of daily newspapers was 103%, meaning that because of morning papers and evening papers, more than one per household. Going down, 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 but the industry was still making money. And then by the late 90s, we started having digital disruption. And the digital disruption, especially of the advertising business, the classified business first, started taking money out of the industry. And, of course, readers started migrating from print to digital. And so these were slower-moving trends, but they were nicking the industry. You could see it in the numbers. And then what the Great Recession did was knock an industry on its heels. So when you have an industry that is already weakened, and on a bad trend line, even if the minor bad trend line, something like economic catastrophe, as that was, really did a lot of damage, took basically a fifth of all the revenues out in that year. And since that time, this industry has not grown year over year. So that's now 11 years since this industry has grown. So it's a long, long slide.
You said you worked for Knight Ridder's digital side then.
Yeah.
And I don't know to what degree in 2006 McClatchy had or was really envisioning a digital side. But there has been this criticism or voice that print didn't respond quickly enough to technology, to print, to the new platforms. Maybe you're suggesting that there couldn't have ever been a fast enough response to what the bigger industry was enduring.
Whether it was possible, we could probably debate for a long time, but it is absolutely true that the newspaper industry, once fat and happy, did not adjust. So you had aggregation, you had search, you had mobile, you had video, social, all these things came along. And as the major media in their cities, you would have thought, abstractly, they should have been the ones that would have figured some of this out and could have kept their place. But basically, the disruptors coming out of Silicon Valley beat newspaper companies and really TV companies, all old legacy media, to the punch in all of these areas. But the number one thing, even with all the changes in our lives and the industry we can see, is advertising. And that's where Google and Facebook are now taking 60 to 70 cents of every dollar in digital advertising, and digital advertising is the number one ad type in the country. So it's the loss of $30 billion a year in advertising money to the newspaper industry. Much of that has gone essentially to Google and Facebook through a number of intermediaries, really. But that's really the major drain we're talking about. Habits, yep, they've changed, but it's the advertising change that has really sapped the revenue and caused these huge disruptions and major cuts in newsrooms like The Bee.
Hmm. Used to be the classified ads were so much money moved into a print company. If anybody has had to place an obituary, and I don't know, Ken, if you've had this experience, it's remarkable how much of a revenue source obituaries must have become, because the prices sometimes are astronomical depending on the market.
They are astronomical.
Yeah.
Well, and if you look at papers, you know, we've seen written in the last year with a lot of the press woes, the question of news deserts of communities that simply don't have any paper left, but even more so, I think we see ghost newspapers that they still get printed, but to your point, you know, they will have three pages of obits, and it's not just the aging population. You know, this is the one big revenue source, as other revenue sources have gone away. So it also points to the fact that newspapers are still a preferred medium, basically, of people 65, 70, and plus. And they're living longer, and they're paying double or triple in many of their communities what they paid to subscribe compared to 5 years ago. But this is not, obviously, a growing market. It is a market in decline. And what we're seeing is, as I've covered this industry overall, is financial companies, and now we have Chatham Asset Management, which will take over McClatchy, and we have others with other companies. The financial companies are getting into this, which is a declining industry, and they're saying, we know how to take profits out of a declining industry. It's not a very appetizing thing for many people in business to manage down a business, but these financial companies are willing to do that. And that's going to be the major question, really, for McClatchy and the Bees here in California, of what is it going to mean to have the McClatchy family out of direction mm-hmm. of this company at this point, and to have a financial company in the driver's seat.
You're listening to Ken Doctor. He is a news industry analyst. His book from 2010 is Newsonomics. We could get to some specifics about your book, but I want to follow what you're saying right now.
Sure.
And you've been quoted about Chatham Asset Management, and they are not the only financial player right now that is either controlling or in a situation of controlling daily news. So a lot of people think that this company is going to be broken up and sold off because it'll be controlled by a hedge fund. What about that?
It could be. Basically, all alternatives will be on the table. So when we have leadership like McClatchy's, and this is true in the industry generally, These were families that came out of a geographic area. They had a civic mission in addition to running a profitable business. Now, with companies like Chatham, the question is simply, how do you maximize the revenue? If it is running McClatchy as the 30 papers that it is across the country and making money because it is a profitable company with close to $100 million a year in earnings, they'll do that. They'll run it. If it is better to merge it with another company and they can make more money over the next 2 or 3 years when they pencil that out, they'll do that. And yes, they could sell off selected properties, although that's getting harder and harder to do because so many of the operations of all these newspapers are now centralized. So a buyer is buying an uncertain prospect, of course, in a declining industry, but then a buyer oftentimes, and we've seen this in other places in the country, Boston, Los Angeles, and others, then has to basically recreate a business, recreate technology that has been centralized. So it's a dicey proposition to buy one of these at this point, and that, of course, makes it harder to sell. I think the greatest likelihood is that Chatham will look for a merger partner. Mergers whack a lot of headquarters staff, meaning people, executives, and that takes out a lot of cost. Taking out cost creates more profits. So we've had one major merger, which was completed in November between Gatehouse and Gannett Newspapers, creating the largest newspaper chain by far, 25% of all the circulation in the country. And we're seeing the same thing now in Chicago with the company MNG that runs a lot of papers in the Bay Area and L.A., really getting very close to Tribune and probably close to merger. And I think that it is likely that Chatham, if it already has not had those talks, is going to have those talks on merger. And then we'd see still a new ownership. The Chatham ownership, after it emerges from bankruptcy, might be a very short-term one.
I mentioned that the judge had ruled that mediation could begin in 2 weeks, and that was characterized as sort of a fast track. Does that mean that this process is going to move or could move quickly?
It could. That's what they wanted to do was, is what is called a pre-pack bankruptcy, where you basically you go to bankruptcy court and say, we've talked to everybody, we've talked to all the creditors.
Right.
You know, it's a regrettable situation, but we all agree. This is the resolution of the debt and asking the judge to approve it. They could not get that done. But they still want to avoid kind of a full-blown bankruptcy interim, which can take months and months and months. And so what the mediation allows is basically the negotiations with the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is going to take over all of the pension obligations of McClatchy. This negotiations, really, of what is PBGC, this federal agency, going to get from McClatchy? It's going to get some money, not a lot, but it's going to get some millions of dollars, and it's going to get some equity, some shares in this new company. So the question really is going to be, how many shares is it going to get? How much money is it going to get? And it's also contesting, it's kind of arcane, but it's contesting how Chatham, which is the major lender and the major investor, restructured its debt with McClatchy 2 years ago. But out of that, McClatchy would hope that they can get a resolution, which they have not been able to get through talks for several months, get that resolution. The other creditors are pretty well in line other than other pensioners. There are other pensioners that are contesting it, but they would hope to get this still done in 60 days and then basically be able to focus again on the operation of the newspapers.
So McClatchy has reassured everyone that newsrooms will stay intact in the interim. The papers will continue to go out in print and digitally the way that they were. What do you think happens after that, and what would a subscriber want to do at this point?
There isn't really much to do at this point. They've got lending, essentially interim lending, to make sure they can have a smooth operation, and that will continue. So, in a sense, this is almost like a little quiet period. It might be 30 days, it might be 60 days. The McClatchy newsrooms have absorbed, like newsrooms around the country, lots of cuts. And those subscribers have noticed writers and columnists disappearing, as they have across the country. That's not going to pick up any speed, I think, during the bankruptcy proceedings. And it's basically wait and see for the journalists at the papers and for the readers. And then the question is, what happens to these papers afterwards? What one would hope is that some ownership might emerge that would reinvest in these papers, as we've seen at the L.A. Times, the Boston Globe, the Star Tribune. It is unlikely that Chatham is going to make a major investment in that from its own background, but that would be the greatest hope. But at this point, there isn't anything to do but wait and see what happens.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Ken Doctor about the McClatchy Company bankruptcy filing, which was announced last Thursday. We'll post a link to Ken's website. His book from 2010 is Newsonomics, and he talked about trends. You did talk about trends, Ken, that you said are going to shape the news you get, a biggie being technology. I think you're a big fan of the technology changes, aren't you?
Well, the technology changes in our entire world are ones that we have to accept. And most everybody listening here, we're all using mobile phones as a primary source of communication, of news and information. And there's a lot of wonderful things that have come out of the digital revolution. What news companies need to do, especially as we're into the 2020s now, is harness that technology to do and distribute their journalism. And the ironic thing, even though I've seen such loss in local newspapers across the country, the New York Times, for instance, and I've covered national as well as local, the New York Times now has almost 5 million subscribers, which is three times what it ever had at the height of print. So it is the mastering of this technology to get more reader subscriptions, to produce more journalism, more high-powered journalism, visual journalism, investigative journalism. When it's used that way, and then you use it to distribute your work, it can work and it can actually build a bigger business. The tragedy here is that local newspaper companies, by and large, either did not invest early on in the technology or didn't have the vision to deploy it. And then, because the world changes very quickly, they ran out of money, and they are not investing enough at this point to do the kind of things that the New York Times and the Washington Post are doing. But technology is the basis of much of the news industry, and in a very good way when well used.
To back up your point about growing readership, in July of 2018, I talked with Lauren Gustus. She had been named at that time the new West Region editor of the Sacramento Bee. She's still with the Bee. And she was talking about supporting local journalism. She said the Bee already at that point was reaching more people than the paper ever had, and that the audience was growing. But there was a target of getting 60,000 digital-only subscribers, and the paper at that point had 15.
Right.
So tell me about a business model for funding print journalism on the digital side, I guess, that will work, and what the math is, at least as you know it to be, in terms of subscribers.
So it is an absolute fact that if you measure reach, meaning how many people you are reaching in a given month, of course, digital media allows you to reach far more people than you could ever do in print. And let's remember, the old print model was not as mass a model as the internet can be, because you know we can type in a few words and we get to any site. It was always a paid medium. So the problem is that you can have a huge audience, a digital audience, but if you only get 2% or 3% of that audience to pay for the journalism, it doesn't do you much good. You get a little advertising money off of that mass audience, but you need digital subscribers. McClatchy has grown a lot. I think its number is 200,000 across the country, but of course that is 30 newspapers. So the local newspapers, who are all trying to sell digital subscriptions, have run into this wall. They say to people, buy a digital subscription, and generally for younger people, people who don't have print, and because they have cut back on their news content so much, and oftentimes their mobile products are nothing special, it is a tough value proposition for consumers. So consumers will pay for Netflix, they'll pay for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and many other things now, but they're finding it's a tough value proposition. On the other hand, if we compare New York Times now has 50% more journalists than it had 7-8 years ago, produces a lot more content, has a great product, and for $15 a month, you get real value. It is hard for local news companies at this point, lacking funds as much as they do to offer either the content or the products, so we've seen this downward spiral.
Well, plus the Daily jumped in with a podcast offering as well that's hugely popular. Again, requires additional staffing and additional newsroom, but it's another place to reach a digital audience.
Exactly. And what that has done for them is really what we call discovery. Many people, especially the Daily pulls in a lot of younger people into the Times who didn't really know about the New York Times before. But they made that investment. I covered that from the beginning. They just had 5-6 people at the beginning doing it. Now they have, I think, in the 20s doing that, and it's a major franchise. We have not seen that kind of success on a local level. And to be sure, the Internet does reward scale. It is better to be a national global player like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times than it is to be the Sacramento Bee. Yet a lot of the techniques that we see at that national global level have been really imperfectly applied locally. Again, partly investment, partly vision, even though we have, and I think it's really important to point out in Sacramento and across the country, McClatchy papers continue to distinguish themselves in enterprise and investigative reporting. There's no doubt the resources have dwindled. But there has been more of a commitment from McClatchy Papers to get into serious issues, to do investigations, than a lot of peer newspaper chains at this point. And I'm afraid that could be lost as this bankruptcy washes out.
Yeah, it's a hard point to raise up and highlight in the midst of what looks like the bigger sinking ship. But I think, as you keep alluding to, we'll see there are a lot of answers that need to come out of this. By the way, we did reach out to McClatchy to have Lauren Gustus join us again on the show. We couldn't make that happen today, but we continue to try. Her phrase at that point was, we have to have a plan for a sustainable future. If McClatchy isn't parceled out and sold off, is there a sustainable future here that can be created in perhaps, as you suggested, a merger partner or some other configuration?
It potentially, yes. Unfortunately, the marketplace, if we define sustainable as no more cuts to the newsroom, actually building up what the content and product is of these local papers so they can do more in their communities, we don't have that from these mergers and acquisitions. What we see in the mergers and acquisitions is more cutting, mainly non-newsroom cutting, but we do not see additions to the newsroom. Really, to create that model, and use the best regional models in Boston and Minneapolis at this point, you have long-term owners there. These are wealthy people, billionaires, who have bought those papers, who have reinvested in those papers. They put in millions of dollars. They have actually added to the newsrooms marginally. But they've also said, we're not going to take profits out of here, or very minor profits in Minneapolis. We're going to reinvest. This is a 10-year strategy, and we're going to continue to sell more of those digital subscriptions. They're up to more than 100,000 in Boston, I think approaching 150,000 and 50,000 in Minneapolis. And they are more stable enterprises, but they do take deep-pocketed owners who really have a civic mission as well as a business sense. And so there's just, something like 642 billionaires in the country now. It's a lot of them, but only three or four of them own newspapers. If we find the right one, I kind of call it billionaire bingo. If you find the right one, your newspaper can be secured and maybe brought into the future. But across the country, the mergers and acquisitions usually just mean slowing the decline a bit, but still maintaining the management of a declining property.
Thanks so much for making time for us.
You're
welcome. It's been, I think, a really important conversation to have across the country, and in particular here in Sacramento, as you know.
Sure.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Ken.
Yep.
Ken Doctor is a media watcher. He is the author of Newsonomics. You can find a link to his website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. There are some great entertainment options in Sacramento and across the region this weekend, so look out there, get out there, and enjoy something live. We're going to post links for a few on our webpage. B Street Theater has a terrific play in its family series. It's titled Ride, Sally, Ride. Sally Ride, of course, is the first American woman in space, but she's a girl in high school when we meet her. She has been shut down, put down, and laughed at by her classmates and her teacher. And then she's befriended and mentored by one of the first American women aviators, Amelia Earhart. This is a high-energy, super fun show. Brittany Barger and Elizabeth Nunziato are terrific in their title roles, as is the rest of the cast. It's such a positive show for young girls, but there's a lot of inspiration in this one, really, for anyone and everyone. So this play, Ride Sally Ride at B Street Theater, continues through February 29th. Cirque du Soleil's beautiful show, Ama Luna, has been so popular. Its Sacramento run is being extended through March 1st. You can't miss the giant blue and white tent in the West Sacramento parking lot of Sutter Health Park, formerly Rayleigh Field. I need to tweet a picture of this tent. All right, I'll do that as soon as I get a chance at Cap Radio Ruyak. The clown, Kelsey Custard, is from Sacramento. She's hilarious. She is so natural, so funny, and really a star. And you'll just like the experience in this tent. So you can find a link to the show. You can also find a link to my conversation with Kelsey and with Callie the Lizard King, too. So that's on our website. Now, let's go to one more option for the weekend, the Jewish Film Festival. It opens Thursday at the Crest Theater in Sacramento. It continues through Sunday. There are some remarkable films and shorts, and the festival director, Tevin Laxer, is with me for a preview. Hi, Tevin.
Hi, Beth.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much.
So 14 films and 9 shorts. Give me the atmosphere of this year's festival.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I just want to correct one thing.
Okay.
We actually start tonight. We open tonight, Wednesday night.
Wonderful.
So, yes, and tonight we are very lucky to have a prominent Israeli filmmaker who's won many awards. Donny Menken will be presenting 2 of his films, Picture of His Life, will be at 6 o'clock tonight, and it follows the world famous photographer Amos Nahum as he is on his lifelong quest to photograph polar bears in the Arctic without any protection. He goes into the water without any cages or protective gear. That's followed by another film at 8:30 called Alsi, which is the unlikely story of an African American NBA prospect who helps Maccabi Tel Aviv win the European Championship in 1977. So that's our opening night this evening.
So it starts at what time tonight at the Crest?
Well, actually, we have a matinee at 3:15.
Okay.
A documentary about Golda Meir. At 6 o'clock, Picture of His Life, and 8:30, the film Alsi, about Alsi Perry.
Talk a bit about that documentary about Golda Meir, because that's another one that really should be spotlighted in this festival.
Certainly. It's a candid look at her time as prime minister, and it focuses on some recently discovered interviews that were taken after she left office. These are interviews that were not to be seen by the public, basically, and the tapes recently came to life. So it's a very candid look at her time as prime minister. It's very interesting that some revere her and some despise her, depending on your perspective.
Some of these films have multiple showings throughout the festival. We've posted a link, but that's an important thing to know, isn't it?
Sure.
The documentary about Dr. Ruth Westheimer, it's one that I've paid particular attention to because I'll be part of an onstage conversation after this film. It's titled Ask Dr. Ruth, and let's go into a little bit of detail about this and the special guest who's coming.
Sure, of course. Well, first of all, Dr. Ruth will be 91. She is still teaching college. The reason we invited her to come in person, but she declined very nicely. And she is still teaching at Hunter College in Columbia in New York City. And, you know, she is an amazing world-revered sex therapist. Her son, Joe Westheimer, is a college professor in Ottawa, Canada. And you're right, he will be joining you on Saturday night on stage. He is the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at University of Ottawa. And he's also, like you, he's a radio host. He hosts the CBC Radio Ottawa Morning and Ontario Today, two radio shows that he does.
I can't imagine what it was like growing up with Dr. Ruth being his mom, but her story, her backstory, I think will surprise a lot of people who maybe only knew her as this iconic 1980s grandmother who could tell it like it was and teach you everything that nobody else would.
Exactly. And also, you know, she was at the forefront of AIDS education and prevention way back when. And, you know, she has spoke candidly about sex for decades, and is just amazing to watch her in this film.
She has a childhood history that goes back to Germany, and a lot of that is profiled. We'll post a link to the trailer. The film is at 7 o'clock Saturday night, and then the conversation will happen on stage afterward. I want to talk about a group of short films. In particular, there are a number of films by this group, Israel 21C, and one of them focuses on the recovery in paradise after the campfire. Would you say more about it?
Sure. That actually is, that will be showing tonight. That shows at 6 o'clock tonight. We have many of our short films are in advance of our feature films, and so this one is will come before Picture of His Life, and you're right. It shows a group of Israelis who are helping the recovery after the campfire in Paradise, and it's one of we actually have 10 short films that we sprinkle throughout our festival, and this is one that we like very much.
We're bouncing around on the schedules, so just know that there is a link, or if you Google Jewish Film Festival Sacramento, look for the 2020 version because this is the 21st year
Correct.
Of the festival.
Yes.
Tell me about curating films and how many choices there are for the festival.
Yes. We have a stellar committee. We probably looked at over 100 films before we chose our 14 features and 10 shorts. So it's a very tedious process. We've even tentatively selected one or two films for next year already.
Oh, wow.
But if I can highlight this, two other films I'd love to highlight. We have another filmmaker coming on Sunday afternoon, and we will actually be the second city in all of North America to have this film. At 3:30 on Sunday afternoon, there's a film called The Albanian Code. The filmmaker is coming from Israel. Her name is Yael Katzir. The film premiered in North America in San Diego at the San Diego Jewish Film Festival this past Sunday. And it's an amazing tale. It's a little-known story of Albania, a Muslim country in Eastern Europe where no Jews were persecuted or deported during World War II. And in fact, they saved Jews from Yugoslavia and Hungary. So it's a fascinating tale. The other film that I want to highlight is our closing film, Oh, and that's at 3:30. Our closing night film on Sunday night is called Those Who Remained. Mm. It was Hungary's selection for Best International Film. And it was shortlisted as one of the top 10. It was not chosen, of course. It didn't get down to the five, and it didn't win. Parasite from South Korea is the one that won. But Those Who Remained is a wonderful, wonderful film that I really strongly recommend.
All right. People can get day passes or movie passes. You can see one movie or the whole festival. You're getting into the digital age with everything on a receipt and a barcode. So I think it's a whole new festival this year. I wish you a lot of luck and congratulations on the choices.
Oh, thank you so much. We look forward to seeing you on Saturday evening.
Yeah,
as well.
I'll see you at the Crest Saturday night.
Yes, thank you so much.
That is Tevin Laxer, director of the Jewish Film Festival. It is Wednesday through Sunday in Sacramento. And again, there's a link at capradio.org/insight. So Tevin, stay put for a minute because we're going to check back in once more with Cap Radio's state government reporter, Scott Rodd. He is at the Capitol in downtown Sacramento standing by. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Beth.
So the governor will give his State of the State address in about an hour, maybe a little less. What have you been able to learn about it?
So I was able to pry loose some details. The governor's office is keeping a lot close to the vest, but I can say that listeners should expect to hear a lot about homelessness. This is going to be a big focus for the governor. We sort of knew that coming in, but listeners should really expect to hear perhaps more than they would have even expected, considering it's such a big problem in California.
Is this going to be treated like an emergency situation? I think last year it's fair to say that it was laid out as one of the biggest challenges facing the state and a crisis, but we're in a different mode of response, both at the statewide and the local level now.
I think it will be framed with a lot of urgency. I can't say if it'll be framed as necessarily an emergency, but I think it's going to be clear that Newsom views this as a crisis for California. You know, in his budget proposal, he said he wants to commit $1.4 billion in spending towards this issue. Since then, the Legislative Analyst's Office, which is a nonpartisan body in state government, they came out and said, well, this plan has a lot of money, but it lacks a clear strategy. And that, I think, sort of sparked something in the governor's office. And I think this may be a response that lays out more clearly and more specifically what this very expensive plan is going to do.
No doubt the governor will talk about California's strengths, its position not only in the United States, but globally, the pluses that have happened over the last year. So I think those of us that have covered State of the State messages fully expect that the beginning of this is a state that's positioned strong. Any indication that that wouldn't be the case?
You know, I can't really say one way or another. I mean, if I were just to speculate, I would say that likely, you know, I doubt that any governor would shy away from, you know, highlighting the fact that their state is doing well. There's a strong economy here. Unemployment is very low. California does enjoy a very powerful and strong position, not only in the U.S., but in the world economy. So I doubt that, you know, Newsom would let that fall by the wayside. So I'm sure we'll be hearing about that as well.
All right. How about a little play-by-play? How's this morning going to go? Session is not even gaveled in yet, is it?
Not gaveled in yet. We're still waiting to have the joint session start, which will be in about 15, 20 minutes. At that point, the Speaker of the House and the pro tem of the Senate will give their speeches, as will the Lieutenant Governor. And then Governor Newsom will come on and deliver his address. Right now, there's a little more activity in the Assembly Chamber where the delivery will take place. From my perch in the press bay, I'm starting to see some lawmakers, some folks from the Speaker's office and the Governor's office. It's sort of like spotting animals out in the wild. You're starting to see them come out of the come out of the woodwork. And so I think there's sort of a building sense of anticipation here.
All right. And your coverage, your reporting will continue throughout the day, Scott. I know you're on assignment not only for us, but the newsroom, and you'll be tweeting as well, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, that is state government reporter Scott Rodd reporting from the Capitol. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you.
The 2020 State of the State event is going to begin soon. You will hear, starting at 10, live coverage, an effort by Cap Radio and KQED. I'll be joined in the studio by Scott Schaefer and Marisa Lagos. Guy Marzorati will be at the Capitol. If you're interested in the meantime in past State of the State messages, jump on to capradio.org. You can find an archive going back to 2004 and hear the presentations by various governors. There's a lot of background on, of course, Jerry Brown's years, but this past year from Governor Gavin Newsom. Chris Nichols from the PolitiFact California team will be joining us as well and looking at promises that were made by the governor and how he has progressed either toward them or regressed in this year. So join us at 10 for our coverage from 10 to noon of the 2020 California State of the State Address by Governor Gavin Newsom. For now, that's Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Stand by for our two-hour show with our broadcast partner, KQED. And thanks for joining us.